Much of the down-home soul I remember hearing from my childhood explored the joys and pains of outside love. It was a popular lyrical theme in R&B in the early 70s.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with Rashad Ollison, whose memoir, Soul Serenade, Rhythm, Blues, and Coming of Age Through Vinyl, was published by Beacon Press in 2016.
I didn't come along until 1977, when disco thumped everywhere, but not in the Ollison household. Blues suffused soul, and traditional gospel sparked good vibes and sustained us through bad times.
Growing up in central Arkansas in the housing projects of Hot Springs in the 80s and 90s, Rashad Ollison experiences a world of
cold love, redolent of vinegar, without the slightest hint of sweetness.
And the only thing that helps him endure is music. Soul Serenade, memoirist Rashad Ollison on Arts and Letters. I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. Today we'll be talking with Rashad Ollison, nicknamed Dusty by his family, who in his memoir details the lives of his often absent father, his indomitable grandmother, Mama TK, his irascible sisters, Dusa and Reagan, and his tough-as-nails mother, Diane.
Desolate she stood, and desolate were her children too. She lived an absent and weary life, and pain was all she knew.
Rashad Ollison, University of Arkansas alum, memoirist, award-winning pop music critic, for whom music was the place where you found the most coherence and delicious engagement. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Why did you call the book Soul Serenade?
Well, it's one of my favorite songs by Aretha Franklin. It was originally done by King Curtis as an instrumental. And jazz artist Gloria Lynn did it in like 65.
Serenade. Serenade.
And Aretha did it on her breakthrough album in 67. I actually heard Gloria Lynn's version first before I knew Aretha's. I love the song, but I thought that the title fit the book. In fact, I had the title before I had the book, actually.
I want to be free to fly away.
You know, I was writing about soul music and serenade being something that soothes and centers you. With that song, particularly Aretha's performance of it, it's sort of this tug between wanting to be free and wanting to be connected, and which pretty much described my adolescence. So I thought that works.
You begin your memoir, Soul Serenade, Rhythm, Blues, and Coming of Age Through Vinyl, with the line,
"The picture revealed the happiness I never knew."
It's a beautiful picture on the cover of the book with your dad and your mom kind of sitting in a club in Juarez, right?
Juarez, September of 1970. They had just gotten married, and my father was on his way to Vietnam, and they went to Mexico to celebrate the marriage. In the picture, they sit in a cafe booth in Juarez, Mexico, in September 1970. Daddy's arm wraps around Mama's slim shoulders, and he presses his dark, angular face next to hers. I didn't see that picture until I was almost 30. And so that photograph of them happy, my mother smiling, and they're young, I'd never seen that image. He gives the camera a seductive stare. With flipped bouffant hair, Mama looks like a member of the Marvelettes.
Oh, yes, wait a minute,
Mr. Her smile is so wide, sweet, and radiant, it melts the heart.
Hey, hey,
on the back of the beat-up black and white wallet-sized snapshot, the names in lovely penmanship, probably Mama's, Raymond plus Diane Ollison. Now, they divorced when I was 6. By that time, the marriage was very, very different.
Tell us about your mother, Diane.
When we were growing up, Mama was more of the quote-unquote patriarch, and that she wasn't the emotionally available person who was going to sit and hug and kiss you and all that. She was making sure that food was on the table, bills were paid, and things were done. She developed from the fruit of a flower, but that flower had to die. Her soul has now been emptied. She hangs her head to cry. And my father, you couldn't depend on him for anything, you know, but he was very much emotionally available and affectionate and huggy and kissy and all of that.
But one thing you could count on with your father was his record collection.
Absolutely. He fostered my love for music. And this started early. And so around the time I was in kindergarten, he would take me after school. I went to Langston Elementary in Hot Springs, and that was a record shop in downtown Hot Springs. I mean, he took me to the section where that were used records, so I didn't know what I was picking out. And so I would go by the color of the labels. Yellow was Stax, purple was the sole subsidiary of Motown, and those are my favorite colors. So there was a lot of Staple Singers and, Gladys Knight and the Pips. The Junior Walker and the All-Stars. Bobby Womack. I was the first brother of five. And he would tell me, this is music you should know. So it was something of an informal tutorial on soul music. And so when my parents divorced and he left the family, he bequeathed me these records. And I missed him so much that listening to these records, I was trying to find who I thought he was in the music and ended up finding myself. As the shattered pieces of the marriage settled around her, Mama knelt at the altar of Aretha.
Tell us about your relationship with Aretha Franklin and your mother's relationship serendipitously through the music.
Aretha was one of the first voices I remember hearing, other than my mother's. So there was always this voice in the back of my mind that was there. So I can't imagine my life without knowing Aretha's voice. And it was commanding and it was strong. You just couldn't deny it. I remember people's reaction to Aretha's music, because it was always on. People, you know, even when there was songs like Rocksteady, Chain of Fools, Departed songs, people kind of grooved to it, but they didn't dance to Aretha, you listened to Aretha. And certainly on the ballads and on the Amazing Grace album, you know, it was a certain sort of reverence that rained down in the room and people just kind of paid attention. So much of Mama's life was reflected and refracted in Aretha's lyrics. The longing, the loss, the hope, the faith, the perseverance. And in her music, Mama always seemed to find a home.
You talked a little bit about your father, and in a lot of ways, this book's about your father, even though he's absent from much of it. Tell us about your relationship with him and how it changed.
Well, he, from all accounts, before he had gone to Vietnam, or was drafted into Vietnam, was this sheltered, spoiled country boy. Very jovial. You know, he lived in a part of Malvern, Arkansas, East Section Line, that was full of his relatives. You know, he came from a huge family, so he was very sheltered. And then, you know, there's a lot of men who were drafted in Vietnam at that time. They came back, I guess we call it shell shock. I learned this after I finished the book. My aunt told me that he had been trained as a sniper and killed children, and, you know, that really messed him up. And he had come back addicted to heroin. So from all accounts, after Vietnam, he was never the same. I knew the volatile side of him, but he was also this something of a kid himself. I mean, he was he used to watch cartoons and old westerns with me, and he never treated me like a kid. He treated me like one of his ragtag friends. So, you know, I'm 5-6 years old, and he's bringing me along to his girlfriend's house, drinking buddies in little rundown little bars. I remember in Hot Springs, we would go in, you know, and he'd drink and he'd buy me a Dr. Pepper, and I was just hanging out with him. So in my mind, he was just this cool guy. But I didn't have the language for it at the time, but I do remember that there were episodes of his being just disturbed. He would cry a lot, and he and my mother fought. And he would become so pitiful. He'd cry and apologize to us. You know, I knew as a kid that there was something not right with him. Once he left the family and he was pretty much gone, as an adolescent, I missed him a lot and felt that I needed his validation and he wasn't there. So this admiration I had for him turned into this seething anger. I almost hated him, you know, for not being there. When he died, I don't remember grieving him at all because I was just so filled with this anger at him for not being the man I thought he needed to be. You know, in writing the book, the biggest takeaway was that for me, the pain stopped when I stopped trying to reconcile who I thought he was with who he was.
I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and you're listening to Arts and Letters. We're listening to Arkansas writer and music critic Rashad Olison talk about his memoir, Soul Serenade. So there's the physical father, mm-hmm. but then there's also the ghost father, mm-hmm. who appears in a variety of places, mm-hmm. when you're in church, standing in the back, when you're reading poetry.
You know, in this book, in my mind, I would see him. And you know, that happens a lot when you think about it. When you miss someone, whether they died or they're just out of your life, if you miss them enough, you think you see them. I thought the best way was to use magical realism in a way to write him as this ghost character who just kind of comes in and out. I wanted Daddy to appear, and suddenly, there he was, sober, groomed, and handsome. He grabbed Mama, their smiles met, and the room became a bright and infinite place in the sky. Mama threw her head back, flashing the smile she wore in Mexico all those years ago. A silly song about a rubber band man had lassoed joy and made all well again. Then the record went off. Mama stopped dancing, and the ghost of Daddy vanished. And the editors, when I was explaining that to them at Beacon, they were initially like, I don't know. But I said, well, just trust me on this. I'll just write it, and you can see if it works. And they were very adamant about, well, once he comes back as the real Raymond, you have to make that very clear to the reader. And, you know, writing it, the way he came back to my life, it was very clear because the man who haunted me was not the man I saw when I met him. Something sacred, something pure. Daddy haunted every room on Garden Street. He lived barely an hour away in Malvern, but he may as well have been across two oceans because he didn't come around. In the new room I shared with Reagan on Omega Street, I kept a stack of 45s he bought me, music that connected us. His love caged him and set him free, and I didn't understand how both could be possible. Pain seared David Ruffin's voice as he walked away from love. It's not that I don't love you. The cha-cha rhythm and celebratory horns leavened the sorrow. Gritty and commanding, then airy and silken, his voice was sunlight and shadow.
Let's talk about this moment. Your mother, there was Aretha. With your dad, it was a variety of different singers, but David Ruffin was certainly one. You put in moments of music and your thoughts about these real singers that were also ghost figures in your mind.
That just came to me. I thought that to have these sketches there, sort of pullaways because they're italicized in the text, to give the reader a sense that we're leaving the narrative for a moment and falling into my mind as I'm listening to this music and trying to figure out who Daddy was based on these lyrics. Because these were records he loved.
Because everybody needs something or someone to love.
And these were songs that by men like Bobby Womack and David Ruffin, whose music was a mixture of vulnerability and strength. They sang with this rough and then this smooth edge. Particularly that song, Walk Away From Love by David Ruffin. You know, he sings in this commanding, gritty voice, and then there's that part before he hits the chorus where he goes into a falsetto. And Bobby Womack was one whose music was the same way. It was this sort of down home, we're sitting in the pool hall having beers, talking about love and the philosophy of love. And it was, a lot of it was very true.
She's telling me about the things that a girlfriend's got.
In a very earthy language, and of course there's this swaggering rhythm behind them, this, you know, deep bass lines, and it's a very masculine type music. And I thought all of that embodied what my father was about.
If the streets you lived on during your early childhood were fictionalized, their names couldn't have served up a more stark contrast between life as you wanted it to be and life as it was. And these streets' names, if you were to fictionalize them, no one would believe them. Right. We got Garden Street, Omega Street, Happy Street.
Right.
None of these epitomizing the things that they were named, right? Garden Street was not a garden. Happy Street was not particularly happy. But
Omega felt like it was the end. I initially thought that I would appropriate parts of my childhood for a novel, but the names of the streets, the name of these people were just so rich, I couldn't make this up. Reagan and I rode our big wheels up and down the hill in front of our house. Drunks staggered out of the dives and liquor stores on Alvin Avenue.
Tell us about your sister, Reagan.
She's a year and 5 days younger than I am, so on the street they call that ghetto twins. We were very close. We were very different personalities. But what's interesting, Reagan was always my protector, and she still is. We're both aggressive personalities in our own way, but, you know, I'm more gregarious and more, we'll talk with folks. Reagan is very much to herself. She's married and has children. She loves this domestic life and very much almost like a black Roseanne.
Your family relied on, and you write, blues suffused soul and traditional gospel. What was the relationship of music to the rest of the people in the family?
Well, the gospel and the soul music spoke, I think, to their aspirations and who they were. The music that they listened to, and this is like bluesy soul music by like Denise LaSalle.
Somebody tell me, what is this man like?
Lattimore.
Well, sit yourself down, girl, and talk to me.
And a lot of stuff that you hear on Southern radio stations. ZZ Hill.
Your party's jumping, and everybody's having a good time.
Shirley Brown.
When you have done the same thing too.
You know, these were songs that lyrically, they were messy. It was always some love triangle or, you know, I miss my baby, cry my beer sort of thing. And of course, the gospel was, you know, Clare Ward singers. Dixie Hummingbirds, the old school gospel.
Trouble's in my way, Lord. I've got to try some time.
And they talk about these artists and the music as though they were relatives. I mean, they had to testify to the music, and the music, it provided solace and escape for, you know, these working class, working poor people in these communities. But it also, I remember these car parties. Glorious car parties they would have, and depending on what song was played, a fight might break out because it was like, you know, it reminded them of, wait, I meant to put you out.
Used to get my love.
You did that. I remember when that song was out, and that's what, you know, something would happen that would trigger a memory and would get folks to fighting.
I used to be.
And, you know, they'd have to take the record off. So music had that very visceral effect because people took it very seriously. You know, it was just as much a part of their lives as going to the grocery store, going to the post office. It was always there, and it was a constant. As growing up, you heard music coming out of a neighbor's house. In the summertime, people dragged their stereo speakers out on the porch or their boom boxes. And it was a constant presence. So it's like another relative or something.
And you write, music sparked good vibes and sustained us through bad times.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about some of your musical heroes. Mm-hmm. Stevie Wonder.
That girl thinks that she's so fine.
The man-child smile behind every note stretched like taffy.
That girl thinks that she's so smart that soon she'll have my heart.
When I listened to Stevie Wonder's music, even as a kid, there was something about the way he sang. His voice sounded like happiness to me. There was no way I could listen to Stevie Wonder and feel sad. The first song I remember by Stevie Wonder was called That Girl. And it was the jam that summer, and it was all over the place. But there was records in my father's collection, The Inner Visions, and fulfilling this first finale. And of course, Songs from Key of Life that I remember hearing. And his music, it's ingratiating. You know, it sounds human to me. Even when he's singing a sad love song, there's something about it that feels infinitely optimistic.
And then we have Chaka Khan.
Mm. I could exhale and surrender to a woman who tamed lions in her backyard and kept a full moon somewhere in her purse. I started to engage her music around the time I was in fourth grade and I was being bullied. And it was something about the way Chaka sang. You know, she comes from the school of Aretha. She certainly was deeply influenced by her, but Chaka has her own edge. Whereas Aretha was trained in gospel, Chaka was trained in jazz in the streets. And you can tell that by the way she sings, the way she sort of attacked notes. Now, of course, I'm talking as a music critic now who writes and can put this into language. As a kid, I understood that this was a fiery voice that sounded like defiance.
And of course, Michael Jackson.
A chauffeur opened the back door. Michael stepped out wearing dark aviator shades, his famous red leather jacket with studs and zippers, and signature glittery socks and one glove.
You had vivid dreams where Michael comes up to the door out of his limousine, mm-hmm. takes you into the limousine, and off you go.
Yeah, it was a rocket limousine. Walked up onto our porch and knocked on the door. I answered. His smile was wide, his glow almost blinding. Okay, that's Michael Jackson gonna look like that when he comes to get me out of the projects. And we're gonna get in this limo, we just shoo, fly away.
I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and you're listening to Arts and Letters. We're listening to Arkansas writer and music critic Rashad Olison talk about his memoir, Soul Serenade. So tell us about Mama TK, because there's a whole lot of background.
There's a lot there. You know, people have memories of their grandmothers being these sweet women and, you know, loving and doting. She was none of that. And, you know, fortunately for me, my paternal grandmother, we call Big Mama, she was that. So I had a balance, but Mama TK was not that. And so with her, I realized that there was this pattern of abandonment in the family, that people were either emotionally or physically abandoned. She had been raised by her grandmother and aunts, and her mother abandoned her. People who feel abandoned, they sometimes never get over that, and it becomes a filter through which they see life and they harden themselves. And I think that's what she did.
Yeah, you said that visiting Mama Tea Cake in the summer was like doing a stint in jail.
Yep. She was a bootlegger. She sold liquor and fried pork skins, and they were actually pretty good. You know, she made her own barbecue sauce, and people came for miles to buy them.
Do you think she was angry with you because she just really didn't like your dad?
She had her favorite. She liked my older sister, Dusa. She made her differences, even among her own children. I don't know why she didn't like me in particular, because I look like a composite of my father and my mother. She made up her mind that I don't like that boy. I'm like, okay. Dusa was Mama's partner, and Reagan was the baby, seemingly in constant need of attention. I was needy too, but I hid it, or tried to. I always felt pressure to be a big boy, stoic and unaffected, but I always felt what I felt intensely, and that seemed to annoy everyone in the house.
You write that in school there were essentially two yous. Mm-hmm. There was Rashad, and there was Dusty.
Mm-hmm. Dusty was my nickname. Rashad is my given name. And I had been called Dusty. I'd gone by Dusty up until like the fourth grade when we moved to Little Rock. Dusty was the sensitive little boy whose feelings got easily hurt. And I thought, okay, Rashad was going to be this guy who wasn't going to take it. And he was going to sort of reinvent himself and ingratiate himself with particularly the boys, because boys always ostracized me. Dusty showed up at school one day and ruined everything. Rashad was in the good graces of his classmates, or so it seemed. Shy without an athletic bone in his body, Rashad usually didn't participate in basketball games at recess. Instead, he shadowed the boys, staying a few paces behind, and laughed along with everyone else whenever Robert, the leader of the pack, made a stupid quip. Rashad kept his hands still as he talked, and he affected the slightly lumbering walk of the other boys. But Rashad didn't show up one day, and Dusty did.
Dusty shows up and kind of ruins the facade of Rashad.
Right. And the boys were beautiful. The way they sauntered and strutted through the halls, the athletic ones with broad shoulders and stalk-like legs, distracted me. I had no idea what to do with those feelings, and I had no one with whom I could share them. At 13, I sensed that it might be true. But at 14, I had concluded without a doubt what perhaps everyone had known all along.
Let it go, 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 let it go. Let it go, 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 let it go.
And I don't know if you just would kind of talk about your awareness of
sexuality. Yeah, I was aware pretty early. Again, I was always this reconciliation with who you think you are with the larger community. Men in the community who were flamboyantly gay, and they were always ridiculed and harassed.
And every little thing you're feeling inside.
We definitely victimized each other, and there were things we don't want to talk about in the larger world. For fear of being judged by white folks in mainstream. But for me, I saw, I was like, well, look at what we do to each other and how we ostracize each other, which is very much the same way that white folks have ostracized y'all.
It's gonna be all right.
And there were people who were hurt by that. I was to a certain degree, but again, that was that defiant spirit fueled by Chaka Khan that made me think, like, you know, I'm still going to be who I am, period. And, you know, we all have our things we have to deal with and things that haunt us and things we work through if you want to be a better person, if you want to evolve, because it's all a choice. This was part of my evolution. This was part of my healing. I didn't want to walk through a life carrying in this baggage, and I realized these weren't my bags to carry.
Could we read maybe a little bit just toward the end?
Okay. Something toward the end. I watched, as I always did, the label spinning on the turntable. Shamelessly, Marvin Gaye pleaded for his distant lover to come back home, all while remaining regal. Al Green could moan and squeal about the glory of love with his manhood and pride intact. Like jagged blades cutting through the speakers, the primal wails of James Brown and Bobby Womack lacerated the soul and splayed it open.
I don't care.
But as the song faded to a close, something inside had been affirmed and, at last, had started to heal.
Broadcast from the University District, this has been a special program on KUAR 89.1. Thanks for joining us. Arts and Letters and other programming that airs on this station can be found at KUAR.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Thank you to Little Rock musician Tim Anthony, who supplied the soundtrack. Thank you to singer Willie P. and sax man Sabor Salam for the soul-filled sounds. Thank you to intern David Berg. A special thank you to Mary Ellen Cubitt for the sage advice. Thank you to co-producer and sound engineer extraordinaire Mr. Chris Hickey for his quiet expertise and soul certitude. This episode was made possible by funding from the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to memoirist and Arkansas writer Rashad Ollison, whose soul serenades, Keltoid scarred tales of unrequited love, loneliness, and loss, helped to rescue those afraid of not being loved and of not being understood. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's live the words of Claude McKay. If a man is not faithful to his own individuality, he cannot be loyal to anything.